This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk, and today I have the pleasure of talking to Jamie Gordon. She's the author of a novel called Lord of Misrule, and someone I've known for a really long time. How are you, Jamie?
I'm well, thank you, David. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. It's really good to talk to you. We haven't talked in a long time. And, of course, now we have the occasion of your recognition for this book, winning the National Book Award. But before we start talking about Lord of Misrule, maybe we could talk a little bit about your history as a writer and how you got to where you are today. I know your earlier work really well, books like Champ of the City Solo from the 70s, and then in the 80s you were writing poetry as well as fiction. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how you started as a writer.
It's curious that my most surrealistic work was right at the beginning. When most people write an autobiographical coming-of-age novel, I feel that in some deep way, in some intellectual sense, Champ of the City Solo was my autobiography, but nobody would ever find anything in that book that resembles the outward facts of my life. It's about a 16-year-old boy who longs to be a star in Big Yoke, the City Solo, and his means of becoming a star is by practicing an art which is something like oratory. He wants to be a topical tropist in Big Yoke. And I suppose that that in some way that book was a kind of visionary rearrangement of my necessity about doing something with language, and also my infantile notion, which I still have now, that I have to do something with my life that will be a monument for posterity, even though I no longer believe for sure that there will be a posterity. I still feel as a childless person that I have to leave something behind me that that people will know me by, and for me that has to be made out of language one way or another. So I'm very happy to have finally won an award this late in my career that kind of guarantees that more people will look at my work. That's the best part of it. But let's see, after Champ of the City Solo, I did write that that coming-of-age novel.
That was the Ben the Lip? Or was that She Drove
the
Lip?
Oh, I forgot about the Ben the Lip, the kid. Now, I was always interested in writing poetry. I think it was, in some ways, a more natural choice for someone who for whom language always seemed foremost.
And I actually always thought of you as being at least as much a poet as a fiction writer in those years.
The trouble was, though, that I had no patience for the lyric. I wrote very few lyrics, just as I have written very few short stories in my life. Writing lyrics, writing a poem on a single page or two pages, made me want to tear my hair out. I would spend 5 weeks on it, 8 weeks, 9 weeks, and I couldn't get away from it. It was all still me in that one page. It was like a civil war. When I began to retreat to narrative, both in poetry and in fiction, and in prose, rather, it was in part so that I could incorporate time into what I was writing. It was absolutely necessary for me to be able to move away from one site to another within the work. What's more, as a reader, I've always loved the compulsion to find out what happens in a piece of work of any kind. I know that some innovative writers find that element in fiction vulgar, but I'm emphatically not one of them. I can't imagine why every writer who can possibly deploy suspense in some way doesn't want to make use of it, because it's thrilling, and it's the element that captures the reader and draws the reader away from his or her own time into the time of the work of art. So,
right, you enter that imaginative space that's outside of yourself.
That's right, and you can't resist it if you have to know what happens. And
right, it's sort of for the reader, it's the drive of the narrative that captures you and makes you want to keep going. And now, but I guess the question then for you is, do you plot these books? I mean, do you actually create the plot and then write, or does the story, the narrative, evolve as you work?
Well, kind of a combination. I think I know generally where I'm heading with work, and sometimes, as in She Drove Without Stopping, I certainly use the general shape of my own experience. I really did drive out to California all alone after I got out of college, and I had some of the experiences in California that are described in the book. I don't want to dwell on that overly much because I certainly invent freely, and after a while, I must say, I no longer know for sure what really happened and what I made up. I wonder if many writers have that problem.
I think that's probably not uncommon.
An amusing aspect of that, since I'm the only one who writes fiction in my family of five siblings, that is, five including me, and my sisters and brothers do read my books, they can't remember either half the time after they've read my book what exactly happened. It's a kind of a horrifying power in a way to write fiction that causes other people to visualize some sort of hybrid of their own experience and mine.
Well, but I think in a lot of ways that's really what you're describing is the power of fiction, because it's, you know, you're telling a truth that may or may not be literal. And, you know, you're weaving a web of story. I think that's sort of interesting in the sense that, you know, it's like myth, that we don't expect myth to be literally true, but it needs to be emotionally true.
That's right. And I certainly just as soon be completely convinced of the story that I read in a book as left with my own private experience 100% intact and factual. I've never looked on it as anything more than a kind of a shell, so it's fine with me. But it is interesting, as I say, to have the power to actually confuse other people about what happened.
I imagine it could make your family nervous as it might make you nervous.
It does. It makes us all nervous. But then sometimes it's an occasion of conversations. Well, what really did happen, and it leads to new stories and new fictions about those stories. So. So let's see, what have I left out?
Well,
Daniel with the Kid is a narrative poem. That concerned people that I knew in the adult correctional institution, a maximum security jail outside of Providence, where I was invited to teach a creative writing workshop when I was a graduate student in the 70s. And then I came to know some of those people on the street, some that I had known inside, some that I hadn't, and probably got more involved with them than I than was prudent. And I tell that story in the demo with the kid, mostly made out of voices that I actually heard. That's probably the first place where it was noticed in my work that I was really interested in slang and the demotic and the poetics of the street corner, so to speak. It's really one of my most persistent interests. And it combines in my work with an interest in elegant language, too, which I think is, that's probably the most unusual conjunction that's to be found in my work. That is, this kind of taste for elaborate or a taste for eloquence right next to a taste for the extreme demotic.
Right. I actually think that I noticed that quite clearly in Lord of Misrule, that there's a certain amount of formality and in the structure and nature of people's relationships and in the way certain characters think and talk in the book, contrasted to the extreme kind of vernacular voices of some of the other characters. It's an interesting congruency. I mean, obviously, and maybe we should talk a little bit about Lord of Misrule. I know we're skipping over Bogeywoman, which is your second novel, and one that I have not read, so it's harder for me to talk about. But it seems like Lord of Misrule is a kind of, it does come as a further development of your work. It kind of fits in the spectrum, I guess, of what you've done. It takes place in a really kind of low-down horse racing track in West Virginia. I guess it's West Virginia. Charlestown Mound, I think.
Although when I was a young woman, I worked at those Charlestown tracks. And the two young, the young couple that account for two of the four major voices in the novel are coming from Charlestown.
Ah, right.
The track that they go to is called Indian Mound Downs, and it's somewhere along the Ohio River on the West Virginia side in what's called the Northern Panhandle of West Virginia, where there are towns called New Martinsville, Moundsville, on the Ohio side, Bridgeport, Steubenville, and there always were two race tracks. When I was involved with horse racing, there were two tracks around Wheeling, West Virginia, Waterford Park and Wheeling Downs. And I want people who know or who knew horse racing then to think of those parks, but really, the life on that racetrack could happen at any run down half mile racetrack anywhere in the U.S. In its own time frame, which is about 1970.
Right, and it's very richly cast. I think that the characters, you have some tremendous characters who are just beautiful in their in your descriptions of them. It's you really get a feel for who the character is. I think, everyone will have their favorites, I suspect. I thought Medicine Ed was just brilliantly captured. But then there's also, then there's some side characters who add flavor but are also part of the story. The gypsy woman who is owns one of the horses, ends up owning a horse with a couple of the other characters. I don't want to talk too much about the story because I think we'd give away some of the richness for people who haven't read it yet, but this cast of characters is all involved in a horse race that is the, let's say, the finale of the story. And I thought it was really interesting, the names of the horses. That you, and I assume that there is some meaning to this. The term, the horse that's called Lord of Misrule, comes to this West Virginia track from Nebraska as a kind of, you know, it's maybe a race that is set up kind of in order to make money for some of the track people rather than for some of the bettors. But Lord of Misrule is a medieval character who rules over the Feast of Fools.
Exactly.
And then you have another horse in this in the story called the Mahdi, who's the guy, you know, he's a Muslim hero. He's the guided one who is hereafter, you know, to convert people to the Muslim religion. And then you have little Spinoza, you know, the great Jewish rationalist philosopher. So it's kind of interesting, the cast of characters that are the horses.
Right. And then there's one other horse that gets a section named after him. He has the name Pelter, which probably, except for its onomatopoetic beauty, which I always loved, has no real excuse to be in the novel, except that my favorite horse when I worked on the racetrack was a Pelter, and I decided to put Pelter in my book.
Well, and it seems, you know, I don't want to kind of draw this too closely, but it would seem if you have any character in this book that is the kind of representative of Jamie Gordon, it's Maggie Coderer, who is the one who loves that horse.
That's right.
And has frizzy hair, which I sort of is the giveaway. for, you know, because I know you have somewhat frizzy hair. So Pelter kind of is your love interest in a certain way in the story.
Isn't that the truth?
And I noticed that because I'd read this about Bogey Woman, that there's a Coderer in character in that book as well.
That's right.
He's named Ursula.
As a matter of fact, Bogey Woman, which is actually my third novel, not my second, that is, it's the one just before this one, concerns a teenager who realizes that she's gay when she's at summer camp. She's loved summer camp so much that she's gone to camp even at the age of 15, 16, something which I must say, Maggie Coderer, of course she's in a different novel, but the kind of person that Maggie Coderer is would never, ever, ever have stayed in a girl's summer camp. But Ursie Coderer loves camp and then all of a sudden realizes that she is in some sense in love with the other girls. And that so horrifies her, she goes off her rocker and ends up in a psychiatric hospital where she stubbornly stays, thinking that she, as a kind of a monster, belongs for quite a long time until something happens that makes her decide to get better. She falls in love with her psychiatrist, who in some way reciprocates. Anyway, the novel Boogie Woman actually ends with Ursie running away from the hospital eventually and joining her sister at a racetrack. It's a kind of an odd little appendix to the novel, Boogie Woman. But her sister is Margaret Coderer, and Margaret Coderer is the young female protagonist in Lord of Misrule.
So, did you write Lord of Misrule initially soon after you wrote Boogie Woman?
Yeah, actually, I certainly started it soon after. It was definitely the next book that I wanted to do. I had a pretty advanced draft of it already by just about 10 years ago, but I had thought that I had written, compared to every other book that I've ever finished, a book that would be an easy sell. And my then agent didn't have much luck with it after having shown it to 5 or 6 places. And I asked her to show it to Algonquin, which had published my second novel, She Drove Without Stopping. And Algonquin, to my shock, turned it down, saying that they didn't understand the book. Now, that just didn't match my view of the novel that I'd written at all. I went back to work on it, and I made some changes in order to pull a story out of the first 100 pages. That story came out in Witness. It's called Mr. Boll Weevil, named after the first horse in the first race, as it is in the Lord of Mistral, the novel that we're talking about overall here. But once I had pulled the novel somewhat apart, I got distracted with other projects. I put it away. I did what I tell my students never to do. I actually got it into such a condition that I didn't feel I could show it to anyone. And then I got farther and farther away from it, because of other projects that I worked on the last 10 years, and also because of a series of deaths in my family. Bruce McPherson, who had looked at that early draft quite a long time ago, kept pressing me to finish the book and turned it over to him. And I must have made a promise to him somewhere along the line that if I didn't find another home for it by summer of this year, he could have it. And he was, I think, deeply frustrated that I wasn't going back to work on this book. So he simply took the old draft and turned it into unbound galleys and sent them to me, which finally got my attention. I mean, it so shocked me to see this this corrupt draft purporting to be an almost book that I reread the novel. I liked it. I saw how to fix it and went back to work on it, but all in a very short period compared to any other work I've ever done in my life. It was after basically lollygagging around for 10 years, I finished the novel in 6 weeks. And
well, that's actually a great editorial story. It's kind of the story that, it characterizes 20th century fiction in a lot of ways, that it's often the editor who can see what needs to happen, not do it, and you don't want to give too much authority to the editor, but just that by that action, giving you the opportunity to see the novel again. That's a really good way. I mean, it's a good illustration of how publishing should work.
I might mention there was another little aspect that made it hard for me to go back to work on that book. Obviously, She Drove Without Stopping was about a reckless young woman, and Boogie Woman was about a different reckless young woman. I mean, it wasn't the same character, but she was just as reckless, if not more so. The Ben Lilith the Kid was about a reckless young woman. I didn't want to write a fourth book about a reckless young woman, but when I finished that first draft of Lord of Misrule, there she was. However, she wasn't as large a presence in the book as I first feared. I think there was just some kind of self-allergic thing going on there that made it seem, made that aspect seem bigger than it was. What I had been after in writing that book was a novel about a community. I knew very distinctly, in this case, even if I didn't have every detail of the plot, I knew I didn't want to write an interior novel from the point of view of one person. I wanted it to be from multiple points of view and cover, in a way, the social spectrum of a somewhat isolated but nevertheless fully functioning little world. And And it did that better than I had realized.
Yeah, I think it does do that. In fact, it feels like a family novel.
That's interesting. That's a good point. And in some way, I suppose that's what it really comes out as, especially once Maggie and Medicine Ed and Ducey Gifford own a horse together. It does have that, definitely has that family feeling.
Yeah, I mean, and there's certain things, obviously there are things that happen in the novel that are difficult and troubling, but overall, I think the sense, you know, the relationships between the core characters are really familial and strong. And I think that, you know, you've put them in a place which is kind of complicated, but they survive. And I think it creates bonds of understanding and relationship that are similar to the kinds of things that a family goes through.
Well, I'm glad if it works that way, because God knows, family is kind of the precipitating factor for me in all my books. But I hadn't noticed that about Lord of Mistral, but I'm glad to hear it.
Well, maybe it may be only me seeing it. I don't know, but
well, there is a family aspect in that. Unbeknownst to her, at least at first, Maggie Coder is being looked after by her great uncle, who is a loan shark, or as he calls himself, a racetrack financier, who has been ruled off the racetrack because of his unsavory associations and a near conviction in the past. But he finds out that she is on the racetrack, and he has lots of influence, whereas she and the horse trainer she works for have none. And to survive in that world, you need a little bit of inside influence. And that is one of the principal complicating factors of the novel.
Yeah, no, I thought that actually was very much what I was thinking of when I was talking about the family.
I see.
You know, that it's a kind of strange and unusual relationship. It's not literally, I mean, even though they're related, they don't know each other to a great extent or at all. But there's a kind of, I don't know, a feeling there that it kind of keeps the book, I don't know, it kind of keeps the book alive in a lot of ways. And of course, it becomes very important to the way the story unfolds, in the ways that he protects her and cares for her, which I think is really powerful.
It's kind of a book about loners. And to some extent, all of the main characters are in this game by themselves and know it. And the aging ones, and that includes Tutai, the loan shark, and Medicine Ed, this elderly black groom, are fully aware that they're coming to the ends of their lives without family to look after them. So they make some decisions that reflect their anxiety about what's going to happen to them. What will their last years be like? Who will take care of them if they get sick, and so on? Maggie, from where she sits, hasn't even begun to think about such things, and probably remains unaware of what's motivating those two characters right through the book.
Yeah, definitely true. I think she's simply untouched by that part of it. She doesn't even know all of the things that have happened in her behalf in a certain way.
Right.
No, it's really, I think it's very interesting. I want to mention that I think the writing in this book is just beautiful. And I think it really works. It's a very powerful story, but it's also, you know, it shows how good a writer you are. So it's really, it was a fun book to read. It was really interesting, and I really enjoyed it. So
thank you. Thank you very much. What I hope happened with Lord of Misrule, I really, really hope that I've found a niche where there was, where there needed to be a book, but there wasn't one, and that was the world of cheap horse racing, just as the world of boxing, cheap boxing needed a novel to represent it. And Leonard Gardner, who I think is hardly known for any other book, wrote a novel called Fat City, which moved into that niche and is still there. It's a very gritty, realistic novel, not like anything else. And I think it's not a hugely popular book, but many other writers know and admire it. Well, I wanted to write a book like that for horse racing, that was also a fully literary book in the sense it was just as attentive to language as anything else that I'd written, but not hard to, not inaccessible in any way.
No, I didn't think it was inaccessible at all. I mean, I know that that's something that, you know, some of your earlier work can, I don't think it suffers from inaccessibility, but I think there are people who misread experimentalism and kind of the lushness of language and the connection of the present to the past and all, you know, worlds that are slightly askew. Maybe they're looking for a straight narrative and it isn't there. But I think this book is a little bit less. I mean, you still, I like the fact that your worlds are always askew in your stories. They're not literally correct and, you know, kind of normal. And even in this book where it's a universe that's unknown or maybe not that well known to a lot of people, so it's going to it will appear that you know, what we talked about before, the eloquence of language against the vernacular creates a certain almost alternate view, and I think that works here too.
Well, good. I hope so.
So can I ask you, what are you working on now?
My next book, which I already began in that interim period, is about being a Jewish woman married to a German husband and living long stretches of time in his small town. And the protagonist of this book, whose name is Izzy, that's the woman's name, discovers when she spends time out in the woods, which is a very German way of passing the time, that the six Jews from her husband's town who disappeared during the war are in fact still there. They're in a cave. They've been playing cards for the last 50 years. And one of them, a lovely woman, is holding up the game because she just can't play that last card. It's 1936. As far as they know, it's still 1936. And what they are, I mean, they're treated as if they're actually there, and as far as I have the book written right now, I feel they are actually there, and in fact they are taking over more of the book than I even realized, telling stories that are to one side of or underneath or in some way footnotes to the relations between this American woman, this American Jewish woman, and her German husband, who for various reasons are not getting along too terribly well. most of them having to do with her discomfort at living in Germany when she's so aware of the history of where she is. I think that I will continue to develop two stories side by side in that novel. I only have about 40 pages of it at the moment, but it's still a project that thrills me to work on. And since I have already sold the book, I think it's going to be the next thing that I do, like it or not.
Well, I guess some things will change inevitably because of the success, you know, the recognition that you have received with this book, and I think it's a good thing. Hopefully it won't be too much of a burden and will enable you to go back to something like your normal life at some point. But I hope that the writing is not interrupted too much or affected too much by all of this exterior stuff, which is all great. You have to do it, and it's wonderful, but, you know, you got to get back to work, too.
Well, I wish you were sitting right here every day to remind me of that, because it is really hard to get work done when so many public appearances are happening. But I don't think this phase will be temporary, and I will soon be back to work.
Well, I will look forward to further reading, and of course now I got to go back and read Boogie Woman, which I have here and have had for a number of years, and it's just one of those books I managed to forget to read. So,
I hope you do, and I hope you like it. May I say one thing about Boogie Woman?
Absolutely.
That although she drove without stopping, I think, veered back to the world of everyday as most people understand it. And there's a recognizable American family and American college and American highways and American poor people once she gets out to California. Boogie Woman was in some ways a turn back towards an odder universe. It wasn't as highly elaborated in the language as Champ of the City Solo. I couldn't write a book like that again now if I tried. I feel that behind Boogie Woman there is almost a recognizable world, but I allow the society of adolescent mental patients with their rock band to have many private conversations that heighten a sense of it's being a slightly different world from the world we know, but only slightly. And I actually am quite fond of Boogie Woman, and do hope you read it one of these days.
Oh, I'm going to read it soon.
Having
read Lord of Misrule, it makes me want to read another book of yours, and that's the only one I think I haven't read yet, so...
Well,
good.
Curiously, it's a book that's very heavy in dialogue. When I try to think what's the most characteristic gesture of Boogie Woman, I think of these very intimate conversations that three or four adolescent mental patients have with one another. In the privacy of their rooms, in the roaring the mental hospital in question, and I think that it's of a piece with my other work because it is once again so much about a distinctive kind of language that these kids are talking with each other. In this case, it's kind of a heightened adolescent patois. But it's recognizable as teenagers talk.
Right. No, it does seem like a recurrent theme for you because Lord of Misrule includes so much of the vernacular of the track. And it's like you've picked these places where the language is fraught to give you a chance to write in that, you know, in this kind of heightened way.
It's true. I love slang, but slang that... that kind of explains itself as it goes along. And that,
right.
It's not too tied to the fad of any one moment. And then I have to build a bridge between that vernacular and a more eloquent kind of language, that's the language of the fundamental narrator in every one of these books. And I think I do that in all these books, and that's probably the characteristic that brings them all together for anybody who is trying to find a common element among books that are quite different from one another, at least superficially.
I think that's great. Well, listen, it's been wonderful to talk to you, Jamie. It's just been a pleasure. Thank you for talking to me today. This has been David Wilk for Writer's Cast. It's a podcast about books and authors, and I've been talking today to Jamie Gordon, the author of Lord of Misrule. Thanks so much.
Thank you, David.